to another episode of Earth 911's Sustainability in Your Ear, the podcast conversation with a changemaker working to accelerate the transition to a sustainable carbon neutral society. I'm your host, Mitch Ratcliffe. Let's talk about reuse, the easiest way to reduce the carbon emissions associated with a product. Individuals are familiar with the idea of reusing something, but it's been difficult, in fact, almost impossible, to put reuse programs to work in large institutional settings, such as corporate cafeterias, sports venues, hospitals, and schools, where hundreds or thousands of meals are served each day. The kitchens in those facilities are not set up to wash all the reusable containers. Our guest today, Carolyn Vanderlip, is CEO of ReDish, a service that provides reusable food service items, collecting them and returning them to a washing facility each day, then delivering a fresh supply of containers to its customers. ReDish containers offer several number 5 plastic, that's polypropylene, clamshell and round meal containers that are rented on a per-use basis to institutional customers. Customers are also provided with informational guides for diners and a branded set of containers that you can put the ReDish empties in each day for collection. ReDish claims that a company cafeteria that reuses an average of 500 containers instead of molded pulp single-use containers every business day for a year would prevent 125,000 items from going to a landfill. Also, it'll reduce water use by 67% and produce 77% fewer scope 3 emissions, those emissions produced from sourcing, making, and shipping the single-use containers. The company has also declared its own zero waste goal, which it wants to achieve by next year, 2023. They already divert 76% of the waste in its facilities. There are many questions that come to mind, so let's dive into the ReDish story. You can learn more about ReDish at www.redish.com. Welcome to the show, Carolyn. How are you today?
Great, Mitch. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you. It was interesting to learn about ReDish, and I wanted to find out more. So, you come from a background in media, education, technology. You and I have even worked for some of the same companies. What made food service an attractive place to apply your experience and all the lessons you've learned in your career in those other industries?
It's a great question. By the way, you and I will have to, on the side, discuss that. It's not so much that I wanted to be in the food industry as I wanted to take the skills and experience that I'd had over the last decades and apply it to something with significant impact. And when you look at waste management as an issue and how we are addressing it or how we are not addressing it, it just seemed that we could really have some impact in that space that would be lasting. And so it really didn't matter what industry it was in as much as, you know, all the skills that you develop in various sectors can be applied. And I really wanted to apply those to a significant problem that we've got, which is waste.
Well, tell us, what is ReDish's mission and what are your goals? How do you measure whether or not you've been successful in that mission?
So ReDish's goals are to address the problem of waste at scale. And our mission is to do this by offering both reusable products and, more importantly, the service to make them reusable, which essentially means the logistics and the infrastructure and the software that essentially allows for them to be used over and over again after they've been cleaned and sterilized. It is a huge issue in this country and around the world, but we can only tackle one area at a time. I think the numbers that really spoke to me were that we use approximately 1 million food service packaging items, single-use food service products, every year in the U.S., and that actually equates to about 10 million tons of waste. I don't think any of us can even imagine how large that is. I think it's easier to contemplate the fact that landfills have filled up. They're not building a lot more. We're trucking waste, 5-6 hours away. And it's a significant, really, really significant problem, which we wanted to tackle.
So tell us, how does the redish process work? What's involved? I'm a cafeteria at a hospital, let's say. I sign up. What's going to happen?
Well, the first thing that's going to happen is that we're going to work with you pre-launch to understand what the traffic patterns are like in and out of your cafeteria. Because it's not enough that there's a cafeteria. You really have to look at, I take my food out of the cafeteria and I go to my office on the 15th floor, or I go to the nurse's station in that particular example, on the 11th floor. So we work with our clients to look at the traffic pattern of how kind of food service is circulating within the entity. And then we work with them to essentially retrofit recycle bins for reuse or redish bins. And in so doing, it's really easy for the employees, the students, depending upon which entity we're working with, to find the bin to put their redish in. Because fundamentally, if you can't get the container back, it can't be reused. Right. So that's first and foremost. It's a change in behavior to move to reuse. We are a linear-oriented society. We manufacture, we consume, we throw away. Redish is trying to change that pattern, and we know that it's really hard to change consumer behavior. So we're trying to do it incrementally, not to put too many obstacles in that consumer, who in this case is an employee or a student's way. So once we launch with a client, which means they've got all this right signage up and they've trained both the back of the house as well as their front of the house, and they've got employee communication materials to explain the program, then it's no different than a linen service or a uniform service. We deliver 2 or 3 times a week. We pick up every day. We take the dirty containers back to our facility, which in the New York DMA happens to be in Brooklyn, where they are tracked, washed, sanitized, and repackaged for use the following day. So it's a completely circular system, which is very beneficial to the environment because it significantly cuts down on carbon emissions, water, and waste.
So what types of organizations are using the service today? And you're operating only in the New York area at this point?
Yes. Right now we're in New York. As they say, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. We've built our systems and our processes here and are in the process of actually selecting the next 2 markets that we hope to be in the first quarter of 2024. We have the greatest appreciation and respect for our clients. They're all Fortune 500 companies, including the largest tech company in search. You can guess who that might be. And we're really excited because we're launching shortly in one of the largest cultural institutions in New York City. But we're particularly proud of the work that we're doing with a number of charter and independent schools in New York, like School in the Square in Washington Heights, Poly Prep in Brooklyn. What we've learned is that if you can educate a student when they're young about circular, the effects of that education reverberate throughout their lives, because then circular becomes their what they think about, and it really affects so many other aspects of their lives.
You're absolutely right. You build that habit of looking for the deposit box to put it back. And we weren't raised that way, but kids could be. And then that becomes a matter of just regular behavior.
Mitch, now, think of it this way. Think about it this way. Do you use plastic straws anymore?
No.
I mean, I didn't, when they banned plastic straws, my first reaction was, well, how will I drink my iced coffee? I don't even think about a plastic straw any longer. Same with plastic bags going to the supermarket. For the first 6 months after the ban, I can honestly say that I would forget often and feel really terrible when I got there. but now it's second nature. So I call it muscle memory. Yeah. And it's really not hard to create. And once you do, it's a behavioral change that will last a lifetime.
Now, you can make it anywhere if you make it in New York, but how big an area do you need in terms of population to support an investment in a new washing and reuse facility?
You've hit on a great issue because, of course, the infrastructure for that washing facility is expensive. Mm-hmm. But if you think about every community has schools, every community has cultural institutions, hospitals, restaurants. Once you start the reuse habit, there are, you know, ways to actually bring, you know, we're focused today on the institutional market, but honestly, the consumer, restaurant, retail market is yeah. probably just as big. And once you can bring both markets together, you can go pretty deep into the cities in this country. I'd argue you probably can't go deep into rural America. That mm-hmm. would be hard because the last thing you want to do is truck waste, you know, to a facility 100 miles away. But you can really bring reuse to a large proportion of the country.
So let me ask a couple of just basic process questions. One of the things I thought of when reading about ReDish was my time working at Microsoft, where and on the campus in Redmond, Washington, there were at least 20 cafeterias. And a lot of us would take our food back to the office. So putting collection bins in enough places is a real challenge. How do you support an institution that has a disparate workforce around a central cafeteria facility? Do you put a lot of boxes in? And how do you train people to look for them?
Absolutely. It's no different than a company, Fortune 500 company in New York that has 18 floors. Mm-hmm. Most people take their food out of the cafeteria, as right. it turns out, to meeting rooms, to their offices, kind of across the board. That's the walkthrough we do. Mm-hmm. Most of these companies have pantries or some kind of collection center in those 20 buildings, on the floors of each of those 20 buildings, I suspect.
Right.
So we just work with the current system. If you think about it, reuse is just another waste stream. If the building, the company, is already collecting compostable material or already collecting recyclable material or just trash, putting another bin or actually retrofitting an existing bin for reuse is not changing any of the operations. So really, really important because we think the adoption of reuse requires, as I said, kind of minimal behavioral change. So if you're already going to the pantry to get a cup of coffee and you're throwing out your compost there, or very simply, you're just putting your trash there, having a ReDish or reuse bin there that's then collected by the, you know, back of the office operational folks is no different than anything else. The most important part of that question, I think, is the communication. Because we have found that if management doesn't get behind a reuse program and explain what they're doing, why they're doing, mm-hmm. what the effects of what they're doing, then, you know, I as an employee are probably not going to pay attention. So really, communication's key. We provide our institutions with a complete media kit, everything from content for tabletop and posters and digital displays, et cetera, because we think it's really important to educate that employee or that student. Having said that, you know, these institutions want to let their employees know that this is what they're doing, because mm-hmm. guess what? It's what their employees are asking for. So being able to show their employees every day very visibly that they are not just talking the talk of sustainability, but literally walking the walk and doing something is really encouraging, and employees embrace it. So, you know, communication's key, management getting on board, and then making sure that, you know, your audience knows what to do and where to put it.
So you scale up your collection activity based on what the walkthrough produces in terms of their needs. Does the customer pay for lost containers, or is that breakage built into the pricing?
That was
the things I immediately thought of.
Of course. And that's why it's important for management to get them on board and communicate what they're doing and why, because the client, which in this case is the Fortune 500 or the school or the hospital, is who pays for the loss. So everything we do to support the client is to make sure that their return rates are as high as possible. Usually, you know, container gets lost here and there, but we try to keep it to a very, very small single-digit percentage. Can't get it back, reuse it.
Well, so one of the things that might encourage people is the idea that any food waste is also being captured and composted. Do you collect and compost food waste in the dirty containers as well?
So we don't actually have a formal composting operation. That being said, so many of our containers come back with all assorted things inside, not just food. We get a lot of stainless steel flatware from the company. We get, you know, napkins, et cetera. So in our own facility, we separate everything, and then, you know, our compost goes to a composting facility, and our trash goes to the right place, and our recycle goes to the right place. Because it's very important as a sustainability-oriented company that we are sustainable ourselves. So, and then all that flatware that comes back, we wash it and send it back to our clients.
Oh, nice of you to do that. Now, you say that your scope three, that you can reduce a client's scope three emission by 77%. Does that also include your fleet emissions and electric consumption
Absolutely.
And so forth, water usage?
Absolutely.
How do you achieve that level of savings?
Here's the kind of dirty little secret. Almost all of the energy and water is used in the manufacture of the containers. And of course, the real dirty secret is that compostable or molded fiber containers, which is where so many companies moved to about 5 years ago, they actually use more water and more energy than single-use plastic. Obviously, compostable will degrade much faster than single-use plastic. But in terms of the manufacturing, it is five times what single-use plastic is. So what does that mean? If you're going to manufacture a container, regardless of the material, that only gets used once, then that means that every time you have to manufacture another one for the next person's use. The difference with reusable is after four turns, as we call them, of that container, the metrics look like a hockey stick because you're no longer making up for the manufacture of that container. You're now just reducing carbon emissions, reducing water, and reducing waste. I actually did a couple of numbers that I thought maybe your audience would get a better sense of it. Redish is expecting to do about 5 million units next year, in other words, to track, wash, and sanitize a little over 5 million units. That's the equivalent of about 181 metric tons of waste that is not going to landfill. But in terms of carbon emissions, it's about 577,000 kilograms of CO2. That's the equivalent of carbon that's sequestered by 214 acres of forest. So it just shows that by substituting single use with a reusable program on something that people don't even think about, which is the packaging that they eat their food out of, it has tremendous metrics. And those are the metrics that we track for our clients that can then be used in their scope 3 emissions reporting.
So I want to talk more about that in particular, but we're going to take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back, continue the conversation with Carolyn Vanderlip. We're back to continue the conversation with Caroline Vanderlip. She's the founder and CEO of Redish, a company that provides reusable food packaging for institutional customers like hospital cafeterias, sporting venues, and so forth. Caroline, one of the benefits you provide to your customers is the DishTrack dashboard, and it collects environmental impact information like you were just talking about before the break. How does it work, and what is the... what's the impetus driving the adoption of DishTrack amongst your customers?
Well, DishTrack is really the software that we developed so that our customers had an easy way to understand not only the impact metrics, but also the inventory flow. So if you think about reuse and how different it is from single use, you know, you buy your single-use containers, they come in a huge a pallet, it goes in a storage area, and, you know, over the next month, you pull out what you need. Reuse is day in, day out. You don't want to, especially if you're in New York or in a high real estate area, the last thing you want to do is use a lot of space for packaging. So what we do is we provide about 2 to 3 days worth of packaging to our clients, and then track everything we collect on a daily basis and everything we deliver 2 to 3 times a week so that they can understand across the 8 SKUs of product that we offer what they have in inventory to make sure that they never have less than what they need. The other piece is that DishTrack actually establishes PAR levels for each of those SKUs, meaning that if I'm a client and, you know, make it up, I need 500 9x9 entree sized containers for my food service every day, and I want to make sure that I always have at least 1,000 on hand. The moment that dips below 1,000, it automatically triggers a notice to our operations folks that they need to deliver more of that size the next day when they go out. So it's a constant flow in and out, which is what reuse needs, whether it's reuse of our containers or reuse of, you know, gel packs. It doesn't matter what the product is. It can be applied across the board so that you understand that inventory flow. But really what it, you know, what's important is to understand the metrics that are being accumulated and to be able to feed that back to your population to encourage them to remember to put it in the right bin and reinforce why you've adopted this new system. So it's a constant reinforcement.
And that makes a lot of sense. The whole idea of look what we've done together. We've been tracking it and here are the outcomes. But are companies also interested in using DishTrack data in their ESG reporting and potentially to monetize avoided emissions?
They don't really use it to avoid emissions. They use it to show the sustainability initiatives. You know, getting Scope 3 data is one of the hardest areas to find for companies because it's your suppliers, and most suppliers do not track this data. So it becomes really useful for our clients to have that data, both for public consumption as well as internal consumption. If I'm an employee, I want that constant knowledge of why we're doing this program. So, you know, we give our clients kind of impact reports, plus they can pull the data from DishTrack to be able to show that. But the other thing I wanted to mention, if you are an employee or a student, every container, cup, and plate that we produce has a unique barcode on the back. And if you scan that barcode, you'll actually see how many times that particular container has been washed and used and what the individual metrics are for that contribution that you're remembering to put in the right place.
You could have a lot of fun with that in terms of gamifying.
You could have a lot of fun. Absolutely.
Now, you hit on a very important point, that the opacity of scope three emissions generally. You have a very aggressive carbon neutrality goal too. When do you plan to reach carbon neutrality? Tell us about that process, your scope one and two emissions.
Absolutely. So we're working on that ourselves right now. We are close to 90% on waste diversion in our facility. Mm-hmm. Remember, we're bringing in all these dirty containers that have a lot of waste in it. So we have to make sure that, you know, we comply as well and put everything where it needs to go. We monitor our water usage, our electric usage, et cetera. We unfortunately don't use EV trucks yet because they're very expensive for small companies. Right. But we're hoping over the next 6 months that will change. So in general, we're looking at carbon neutrality in our own space, most likely in the next 6 months.
Now, did the Inflation Reduction Act, which provides a lot of incentives for adopting EV fleets, change your planning at all? Do you see an opportunity for moving to those electric vehicles sooner as a result?
I'm hoping so. And the reason why I say that is it's great to have incentives to move to electric vehicles. Remember, we're looking to move to electric trucks. Mm-hmm. And it's great to have that incentive as well, but there is the supply and demand curve here is not working in our favor. Almost every box truck that comes off the line has already been claimed. Yeah. Companies like Amazon and other very, very large fleets are both financing a lot of those operations and manufacturing, and then also taking the trucks that are coming off the line. So mm-hmm. it's hard to find right now at a cost level that makes sense, but absolutely we're hoping that some of the incentives that have been put in place will help change that game.
Now, are you also sourcing low or no carbon energy, and is that challenging in the New York area?
Well, it's mostly challenging because our facility in New York currently, is in a building. We're at the old Pfizer lab in Brooklyn, and it's a 600,000 square foot building filled with mostly food service operations. And so we don't control where, you know, what the building does as it relates to that, unfortunately. But we are over the next couple of years in New York, but certainly as we move into other markets, we will have much more control of the space because we'll be looking at warehouse space that where we are the sole tenant of the space, and we should have much more flexibility in that selection process.
Now, let me ask about the containers themselves, because our listeners are always interested in why people chose the particular plastic they did. You're using number 5 plastic, polypropylene. Why is that Correct. The best choice for a food container?
Well, it's not a question of polypropylene versus other plastic. The reality is the only plastic that really stands up to the washing and mm-hmm. usage multiple times is polypropylene. I think the question we get a lot is why plastic versus other materials. And we look at that constantly. After a 6 month review of every kind of material out there, it really came down to stainless steel and polypropylene. And unfortunately, stainless steel scratches so easily that it looks used very quickly. And part of our promise to our clients is that our containers will look like new, because who wants to eat out of a used container, you know, something that's so visibly been used by other people? It's no different than going to a restaurant, which is, of course, you know, primary reusable, right? You're eating off the same plate and drinking out of the same glass as somebody did probably a half an hour before you. But if you go to a restaurant and that plate is deeply scratched or smells or, you know, has odors from prior food service, you're not going to frequent that restaurant again. So it's very, very important for us that you know, the containers that we use look pristine. And, you know, just so you know, when we take a container out of circulation or out of rotation, as we do almost every day, because a latch has broken or because it looks scratched or has an odor or whatever, we actually send it back to our manufacturer, who takes it down into pellets and then uses those pellets for the lids of our coffee cups. So we are a completely closed-loop system. Our goal is that those containers never get to landfill. So it's not the perfect solution because, of course, there is virgin plastic still being used in this product. But the other piece is we know that there's a huge amount of R&D going on right now, thankfully. Mm-hmm. Lots of companies looking at ways to, provide the properties of plastic without the fossil fuel implications. So we watch those. We keep in contact with them very closely and are waiting for one that will actually produce something that can withstand the washing and the high heat that we use to make sure that everything is sanitized.
It's really encouraging to hear that you can build these regionally oriented closed loop systems around a very specialized waste stream like associated with food waste or food packaging waste. What's the roadmap for Redish? You've mentioned that you're going to open in a couple of more cities in the next year. Do you need to raise a lot of capital to make those expansions, or is just the ability to establish repeat revenue sufficient to finance the growth?
Well, capital is needed, of course. Mm-hmm. That capital is equity today for the first couple that we will replicate. And then the hope is that we've shown how the business model works. To your point, we've got sufficient cash flow that we can actually finance many more implementations with mm-hmm. debt facilities. Unfortunately, as an early stage company, companies don't want to provide debt at this stage, but we think we can make that turn over the next year. Our goal over the next couple of years is that we're in over 20 markets, that we can bring reuse into all of those urban areas. And also remember that when we, like in New York, we're in Brooklyn, but we actually service the whole New York City DMA. So we go as far as Westchester, as well as down to mid-New Jersey, operating out of that Brooklyn facility. So the radius is actually quite large. So going into other markets, we think we can serve a very significant area.
I'm curious, do you see other potential waste streams or food service related processes that you can get involved in and help make circular?
Well, not so much food service processes, but I think there are a lot of other products that companies are now looking, are now trying to figure out if they can be reused rather than used once. I think mm-hmm. the most obvious example is a gel pack. You know, a gel pack is that cold thing that comes with, you know, your wine or your meal kit delivery, right. You know, to keep the product chilly. It's actually less expensive to wash and sanitize and refreeze those gel packs than it is to buy them new. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of companies have recognized that, you know, that is a perfect product to apply kind of our back-end infrastructure too. So it's just an example. I also think, there are a lot of policy initiatives now to make manufacturers more responsible for the life of their product and where that product ends up. And so we're actually talking to a lot of cosmetic companies and others around how to support their efforts to make their packaging either reusable or, more importantly for them, recyclable.
That's very interesting. I look forward to learning a lot more about that as you evolve. Caroline, how can a listener get their company involved? What do they need to do to start a dialogue with Redish?
Well, our target client has at least 400 or 500 people mm-hmm. eating in one space. So, as we've said, it could be anything from a production set which we actually service a few right now, to a hospital environment, to a senior living center, a corporation, a school, et cetera. I think in most places, well, at least in most corporations, there are now chief sustainability officers. Mm-hmm. So bringing to the chief sustainability officer to their attention the fact that we exist would be great. Bringing to the head of operations the fact that this is a great way to show sustainability without changing that operational model very much. Those are the key people to talk to. We had a great story, and I'd love to convey it. At one of our clients recently, they had a town hall, and they were talking about a whole bunch of initiatives. And when the ReDish initiative came up, the employees cheered. So I think fundamentally here, Mitch, employees need to be on the, need to be aware that this program exists and be willing to bring it to the attention of their management, because we're all looking to be more sustainable. And what ReDish offers those individuals is a way to contribute to the effects of climate change. You know, when we talk about things as big as climate change, I think we as individuals feel very little. Like, what can we do to have an impact here? And this is a small way to make an impact, because climate change is so big, but it's real and it's every day. And taking it not just from your corporation or your school, but then kind of thinking about that in your everyday life, we can have real impact. And that's the passion. That's the mission.
Well, Caroline, I wanted to thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
Well, thank you, Mitch. Thank you for having us on. And I hope we can come back at some other point with, real news of growth and metrics for you and your listeners.
I look forward to it.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Caroline Vanderlip. She's the CEO of ReDish, and you can learn more about ReDish at www.redish.com. ReDish is all one word, no space, no dash, no colon, which is actually what the name includes, ReDish.com. ReDish demonstrates the power of digital technology to reshape behavior by tracking and making visible the impact of waste and the benefits of waste reduction. It's interesting to me that, and partly because I've done this myself, that executives who spent decades managing ephemeral digital experiences are now applying those lessons to transforming the flow of physical stuff into circular economies. Software can turn a waste stream into a narrative simply by tracking it. And that confronts society with its wasteful habits while providing an easy solution to reduce the flow of materials to a landfill. So I look forward to hearing more about ReDish's progress and how they might also address other waste streams through their existing facilities. I hope to take a minute to share this interview and all the others that we've done. Please explore our archive of hundreds of programs. We capture these stories, folks, but you're the amplifiers that get people involved in listening and living sustainably. So please tell your friends, family, and neighbors that they can find Sustainability in Your Ear on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Audible, or any of the other fine purveyors of podcast goodness. I'm Mitch Ratcliffe. We're going to be back with another innovator interview soon. In the meantime, folks, take care of yourself, take care of one another, and let's all take care of this beautiful planet of ours. Have a green day.